discovery on its spine. She was moving through it a second time, this time back to front, when the judge called her to answer. She stood and addressed the court from her table. "Your Honor, I can't explain it," she said. "It was supposed to be in a discovery package delivered 2 weeks ago. I have someone checking the emails to defense counsel, but this is the master list I'm looking at here, and I don't see the documents in question on it. All I can say is that it was an oversight, Judge, a mistake, and I can assure the court that it was not intentional." I shook my head, as though I was being offered a deal on an ice cube farm in Siberia. I was not impressed. "Judge, oops is not a legal excuse," I said. "I am unable to evaluate the authenticity, relevance, or materiality of these exhibits. Nor am I prepared to confront and cross-examine this witness about them. I have been severely prejudiced in my ability to prepare and present my defense. The state's lack of respect for my rights has to be corrected. Respect to the system, respect to the court, respect to the rules we all have to learn and must play by." The judge pursed her lips as she realized the discovery violation was confirmed and had to be dealt with. "All right, Mr. Haller. Taking counsel at her word, the violation appears to be a mistake," she said. "The issue now, however, is how to proceed, and that depends on what this evidence means to the people's case and the ability of the accused to confront the testimony and evidence against him. Miss Berg, what is the relevance and materiality of this evidence and testimony? To what issue does it relate?" "These are documents relating to Sam Scales, alias Walter Lennon's, finances and bank accounts," Berg said. "They are relevant to the defendant's motive for killing him. They are crucial to the people's case for special circumstances." "Mr. Haller," Warfield said, "would you please look at the documents provided to you and tell me how long you will need to review and investigate them?" "Judge, I can tell you right now that I will need at least the weekend, possibly more, because the banks are closed over the weekend and my ability to investigate will be limited. But that is only one of the issues. These documents and the testimony related to them ought to be excluded from evidence. The prosecution, in its zeal to—" "We're losing the day, Mr. Haller," the judge said. "Please get to the point." "Exactly," Berg chimed in. "Judge, it is clear that counsel is engaged in tactics to delay the testimony of my witness. He would like nothing better than—" "Your Honor," I cut in loudly, "am I missing something? I'm the victim here, and the prosecution is now trying to blame me for her malfeasance, intentional or otherwise." "It was a mistake," Berg yelled. "A mistake, Judge. And he's trying to make it look like the end of the world. He—" "All right, all right," the judge yelled. "Everyone just settle down and be quiet." In California, judges don't use gavels. It's supposed to be the kinder, gentler justice system. Or surely, the hammer would have just come down hard. In the silence that followed the judge's outburst, I saw her eyes rise above the lawyers in front of her to the clock on the rear wall of the courtroom. "It's now after 3 o'clock," she said. "Tempers are running hot. In fact, you both are bringing far more heat than illumination to this proceeding. I'm going to bring the jury back in and send them home for the weekend." Berg hung her head in defeat as Warfield continued. "We'll take this matter up Monday morning," she said. "Mr. Haller, I want a submission from you to my clerk on remedies by Monday, 8 a.m. You will copy Miss Berg by email with a draft of your submission by Sunday evening. Miss Berg, you too will file your submission as to why this evidence should not be excluded or why other proposed sanctions would be inappropriate. As I have repeatedly said in this courtroom, I take the rules of discovery very seriously. There are no honest mistakes when it comes to discovery. It is the backbone of case preparation, and the rules must be rigorously and jealously adhered to. any infraction, whether intentional or not, must be seriously dealt with as a violation of the accused's fundamental right to due process. Now let's bring the jury back in here so they can get an early start on the weekend. I moved back to the defense table and sat down. I whispered to Maggie. "Talk about falling in shit and coming up smelling like a rose," I said. "Glad now that I didn't let you claim food poisoning?" she said. That falls under attorney-client privilege, not to be mentioned ever again. My lips are sealed. I'll write the motion and get it in. What about sanctions? I feel like we just got them. Her putting this over till Monday is a home run for us. So, no sanctions? I didn't say that. You never miss an opportunity for sanctions against the state. That's just too rare to pass up. But I don't want a mistrial. And if what the iceberg says is true about the evidence being crucial to her case for special circumstances, the judge won't exclude it. Let's think about it some. We have the weekend. I'll take the printouts and read it all over tomorrow, maybe get some ideas. Can you come to Twin Towers on Sunday to meet? I'll be there. Maybe meet Haley for lunch first. Good. Sounds like a plan. The door to the assembly room opened, and the jurors began filing down the two rows of seats in the box. It was the end of day two of prosecution's case, and by my count, I was still ahead. Chapter 42. Sunday, February 23rd. They didn't start moving me to one of the attorney conference rooms until almost 3 o'clock. The runner who took me down was wearing a mask that matched the green of his uniform. That told me that the face covering had been officially distributed by the sheriff's department, a sign that the coming wave was a real threat. When he walked me through the door of the interview room, Maggie was already there and waiting, and she too wore a mask. "Are you kidding me?" I said. "This thing is real? It's coming?" She didn't say anything as the deputy led me to a seat and removed the handcuffs. He then recited the rules. "No touching," he said. "No electronic devices. The camera's on. No audio, but we'll be watching. If you get up from the chair, we're coming in. Understood?" "Yes," I said. "Understood," Maggie said. He left the room then and locked the door behind him. I looked up at the camera mounted in the corner of the ceiling. Despite the scandal and internal investigation that I had tipped off, it was still in place, and we were expected to take it on faith that no one was listening to our conversation. "How are you, Mickey?" Maggie asked. "I'm worried," I said. "Everybody's wearing masks but me." "Don't you have TV in the module? CNN? People are dying in China from this virus. They think it is probably here." "They change shifts in the bubble, and the new people in there with the remotes only give us ESPN and Fox News. Fox has its head in the sand. They're just protecting the president, who still says everything's going to be fine." "Well, if he said it, it must be true." "Oh, yeah, sure." I saw that she had some documents spread out on the table in front of her. "How long have you been here?" I asked. "Don't worry about it," she said. "I got work done." "Did you see Haley today?" "Yes, we ate lunch at Morton Fig. It was nice." "Love that place. Miss it. Miss being with her." "You're going to get out of here, Mickey. We have a strong case." I just nodded to that. I wish that I could see her whole face so I could read her better. Was she just giving me a pep talk, or did she really believe what she was saying? "You know, I don't have it, whatever it is," I said. "The virus. You don't need to wear the mask." "You might not know if you have it," she said. "Anyway, it's not you I'm worried about. It's the air recirculation in this place. They're saying the jails and prisons are going to be vulnerable. At least you're not on those buses going back and forth from court anymore." I nodded again, studying her. The mask accentuated her dark, intense eyes. Those eyes had been what first pulled me toward her 25 years ago. Which way do you think Haley's going to go? I asked. Prosecution or defense?
Hard to say, she said.
I don't know, actually. She'll make her own decision. She did say she's not going to classes this week. She wants to watch the trial full time.
She shouldn't. She'll fall too far behind.
I know. But there's too much at stake for her. I couldn't talk her out of it.
Hard-headed. I know where she gets that.
Me too.
I thought I detected a smile behind the mask.
Maybe she'll go into criminal defense, and we could have a family law firm, I said. Holler, Holler, and McPherce, attorneys at law.
Funny, she said. Maybe.
Do you really think they're going to take you back after this? You've betrayed the tribe, crossed to the dark side, all of that. I'm not sure they let you do that on a temporary basis.
Who knows?
And who's to say that I want to go back? I see Dana in that courtroom and I really ask myself, do I want that anymore?
I don't know.
Once they move me out of major crimes to make room for the young hard chargers like her, I knew my career, it wasn't exactly over, but it had plateaued. It wasn't important anymore.
Oh, come on. Environmental protection? What you do is still important.
If I have to go after one more dry cleaner for dumping chemicals down the storm sewer, I think I'll just kill myself.
Don't kill yourself. Come partner with me.
Funny.
I mean it.
That's okay.
I took that as a hit.
Her quick no reminded me of what had gotten between us and ended things, despite our daughters inextricably binding us together for life.
You always thought I was dirty because of what I do, I said, like it rubbed off on me somehow.
I'm not dirty, Mags.
Well, you know the saying, she said. Lie down with dogs.
Then what are you doing here?
I told you. No matter what I think about what you do, I know you, and I know you didn't do this. You couldn't have.
And, besides, Haley came to me. She asked me to help you.
No, she told me.
She said you needed me.
I hadn't known any of that. That stuff about Haley was new, and it cut me to the bone.
Wow, I said. Haley never said anything to me.
The truth is, she didn't have to tell me, Maggie said.
I wanted to do it, Mickey. I mean that.
A silence followed that. I nodded my thanks. When I looked up, Maggie was pulling the elastic straps off her ears and removing the mask.
Should we get down to business? She said. They only gave us an hour.
Sure, I said. Anything back yet on Milton's phone?
They're stringing that out, but I'll go to the judge if I have to.
Good. I want to burn that guy's ass.
We will.
Sanctions?
She wore no lipstick, and I guessed that she had wanted to keep the makeup off her mask.
Seeing her face now, I got that pang in my chest. She had been the only one who ever did that to me. Mask or no mask, makeup or no makeup. She was beautiful to me.
I say we go big or go home, she said. We tell the judge to put bail back on the table.
I snapped out of my reverie.
As a sanction? I said.
I doubt Warfield would go for that. The trial will be over by the end of this week. She won't let me out just to possibly yank me back in if there's a guilty verdict. And then, I don't think I want to put up a bond for what might amount to just 4 or 5 days of freedom.
I know, Maggie said. The judge won't go for it, and it's a losing argument, but that's just it.
It's an argument, and we start the week with it, and Dana has to expend all her Monday morning energy on it.
Take some of the wind out of her sails, I said.
Exactly. It's a big distraction from her trial plan.
I nodded. I liked it.
Smart, I said. Let's do it.
Okay, Maggie said. I'll write it up and get it to all parties before 6. Tomorrow, I'll handle the argument, too.
I had to smile. I admired how Maggie was justifying her McPherce reputation on both sides of the aisle, and for my benefit. Perfect, I said. What do we ask for when Warfield shuts us down?
Nothing, she said. We just bank it.
Okay. She seemed pleased that I did not push back on her plan. So, where are we on everything else? I asked.
Aparicio, Maggie said. He knows something is up and left town yesterday. By car. Cisco had his guys on him.
Don't tell me he left the state. Vegas?
No, he probably thought he'd be tracked there easy. He drove to Arizona, Scottsdale. He checked into a resort out there called the Phoenician. Cisco will go out tomorrow and hit him with a subpoena.
What if he knows that he doesn't need to respond to a subpoena from another state? It's probably the reason he left.
Something tells me he doesn't, and he left town because he was feeling the heat. He's got to know there's a trial in the murder he's responsible for. Best to get out of town till it's over.
Anyway, Cisco said they'll video the whole thing, make it an airtight service looking totally legit. The question is, what day do you want him here?
We had to think about that. We had Dana Berg's witness list, and from that could extrapolate how long her case might take to put before the jury. We had already delayed things Friday with Drucker, but before that, the prosecutor had been stringing out his testimony in an attempt to run it up to the weekend. Berg would likely shift strategy now and move more quickly with him, trying to build momentum. She then had a deputy coroner on her wit list, the lead crime scene investigator, and then a few ancillary witnesses to follow.
I'm thinking Dana has 2 days left at the max, I said.
I'm thinking the same, Maggie said. So we go with Aparicio on Wednesday?
Yeah, Wednesday. Good. Means I'll be telling my side of this in less than 72 hours. Can't wait.
Me neither.
And our other witnesses are set?
They're all good to go. I have the retired EPA guy, Art Schultz, flying in Wednesday morning. The rest are all local, so we should have everybody on hand, and you can put them on in whatever order we decide works best.
Perfect.
Depending on what we get on the phone records, you can slip Milton in anywhere or make him the grand finale. Have Moira from the bar and then him as the 1-2 punch at the end.
I nodded.
It was good to set up witnesses so that we can handle any surprises or no-shows. Nothing would annoy Warfield or any judge more than having the jury ready but no witnesses to present to them. We needed to avoid that at all costs.
What's our contingency if Aparicio doesn't come back or sends a lawyer to quash? I asked.
I've been thinking about that, Maggie said.
We could go to Warfield for a bench warrant. That'll work across state lines. We'll just have to get the locals out there to scoop him up.
That could delay things for days.
That's why we play to Warfield. No one wants this trial over with more than you, but she's second on that list, and we'll make her see that she's got to use her power to bring Aparicio in. He's the centerpiece of the defense case. This could be reversed if we don't get the opportunity to put him on the stand.
Well, let's hope it doesn't come to that. There was a pause in the conversation, and then I pointed it down another difficult track.
What about the FBI? I asked. Have we given up on that?
No, not yet, Maggie said. I've talked to some people over there, sneaking into my office and using the phone. It helps to have the DA's office come up on their caller ID. They actually take the calls. I'm just trying to get an off-the-record sit-down with Agent Ruth.
That's a long shot.
I know. But I think if I can just talk to her, I can work something out. I know she'll never get permission to testify, but if she would agree to just come in and sit in court when it's our turn to tell the story, we might win her over.
To do what? Testify without the Bureau's permission?
Maybe. I don't know.
That would be fantastic, but no way.
You never know. She's already helped you once. Maybe she'll do it again. We just need to find a way for her to do it. I think she might come to court anyway,
to see what comes out about Aparicio and BioGreen. Well, send her an embossed invitation. We'll save her a front row seat, but I think it'll be a seat that doesn't get used. It appeared we had covered everything. The week ahead would determine the future of my life. I felt confident in Maggie and myself and our case, but the dread was still there. It never went away. Anything could happen in court. Maggie picked up her mask and started looping the straps behind her ears. Even with the elastic, the loops were too tight and pulled her ears slightly forward. In that moment, I saw her daughter when she was younger, and her ears were one of her most pronounced features. "What?" Maggie asked. "What?" I said. "What are you smiling at?" "Oh, nothing. Your mask sort of pulls your ears out. It reminded me of Hay. Remember when we used to say she had to grow into her ears?"
"I do. And she did."
I nodded at the memory and watched Maggie cover her smile. "So," I said, "who are you dating these days?"
That's none of your business," she said.
"True, but I want to ask you out. I don't want it to be a problem."
"Really? Why? Ask me out where?"
"Next Sunday, 1 week from tonight, we go out and celebrate the big NG. I'll take you to Mozza."
"You're certainly confident."
"I have to be. It's the only way to go. You in or out?"
"What about Haley?"
"Haley too. The whole firm. Holler, Holler, and McPherce. Bringing new meaning to family law." Maggie laughed.
"Okay, you're on."
She gathered the paperwork and got up. She knocked on the steel door and then turned back to me. "Stay safe, Mickey."
"That's the plan. You too."
The door was opened by a deputy, this one without a mask, and I watched her go. I realized after the door closed that I was falling in love again with Maggie McPherce. Chapter 43. Monday, February 24th. I was already in place at the defense table when Maggie arrived. She dropped a folded Metro section from the Times in front of me as she pulled her chair out. "I take it you haven't seen the paper," she said.
"Nope," I said. "I asked that it be delivered with my breakfast every morning, but it never comes."
She tapped her finger on a story at the bottom corner of the page. The headline said it all. "Sheriff, inmate acted alone in assault on Lincoln lawyer." I started scanning the story, but Maggie summarized it as I read. "They say that Mason Maddox acted completely on his own when he attempted to kill you. No one put him up to it, and the sheriff's department comes out squeaky clean, even though it was the sheriff's office that handled the investigation." I stopped reading and tossed the paper onto the table. "Bullshit," I said. "Then why'd he do it?" "The story says he told investigators he mistook you for another inmate he had a grudge against," Maggie said.
"Yeah, well, like I said, bullshit. I'm still going to sue their asses when I get out of here."
"That's the spirit." The conclusion of the investigation was not surprising, but it made me feel more vulnerable. If the attack by Maddox had been orchestrated as payback by deputies in the jail, there was nothing to stop them from trying again. The first effort had been whitewashed, so would be the second. I didn't get much time to dwell on it. Judge Warfield soon took the bench, and the jury remained in the assembly room while the hearing on the discovery issue that was revealed Friday continued. Maggie McPherce made a strong argument for reinstatement of bail as a sanction against the prosecution, but it went down without Dana Bergs even having to respond. Warfield simply rejected it out of hand with a simple, "We're not doing that." The judge then asked if the defense wanted to entertain other sanctions. Maggie declined, and the issue was left open, meaning it might come into play and give the defense an edge down the line if there was a tight ruling involving judicial discretion. The hope was that the judge would remember the prosecution's unremedied violation of discovery and tip her discretion our way. Detective Kent Drucker was returned to the witness stand, and the prosecution took up where it had been forced to leave off Friday. As I had expected, Berg shortened her questions and picked up her pace, using the morning session to take Drucker through the post-crime scene investigation. This included the search of my home the morning after I was arrested, which led to the discovery of the blood and the bullet on the floor of my garage. To me, this was the most damning evidence in the whole case, but also the most confounding. To believe I was innocent, you had to believe that I slept through the murder that occurred right below my living space, and then unknowingly drove around with the body in my trunk for a day. To believe I was guilty, you had to believe I went out and drugged and abducted Sam Scales, or had someone do it for me, then put his body in the trunk of the Lincoln and shot him, before spending the next day with his body still in the trunk while I drove to and from the courthouse. Either way, it was a hard sell, and both the prosecution and defense knew it. At one point, Berg put several blow-up photos of my house on easels in front of the jury box to help build the case for the guilty scenario. The house was located on a hillside that sloped down from the rear of the property to the front. At street level was the double-wide garage. Stairs to the right went up to the residential space above, which included the front deck, where I had been confronted by agents Aiello and Ruth. The front door led into the living room and dining room, which were directly over the garage. In the back were my bedroom and my home office. Berg moved Drucker through some testimony involving their testing of gunshots with and without various sound suppressors, so-called silencers, and with the garage door open or closed, in an effort to determine if someone could have broken into the garage, put a drugged Sam Scales into the trunk, and then shot him multiple times without my hearing it from above. Before Berg could ask the detective what his conclusions were, I objected and asked for a sidebar. The judge told us to approach. "Judge, I know what counsel is doing," I began. "She's going to ask him if all of this testing with gunfire could be heard upstairs, but the witness is not an expert in ballistics or the science of sound. He can't give an opinion on this. No one can. There are too many factors not accounted for. Was the TV on? Was the stereo on? What about the washing machine and the dishwasher? You see, Judge, you can't allow this. Where was I in the house when this was supposedly happening? In the shower? Asleep with earplugs in?" She's trying to rebut a defense position before we have even put up a defense.
"Counsel makes a good point, Ms. Berg," Warfield said. "I'm inclined to stop this line of questioning."
"Your Honor," Berg said, "we've gone down this path for the past 20 minutes. If I'm not allowed to finish, the state will be unfairly held in a bad light by the jury. The witness is describing efforts made by the police to see if the suspect could actually be innocent. What happens during the defense phase when Mr. Holler trots out the tired tunnel vision defense? He'll accuse Detective Drucker of only focusing on his guilt to the exclusion of possibly exculpatory evidence. He can't have it both ways."
"You make a good point as well, Miss Berg," Warfield said. "We are going to take the lunch break now, and I'll have a ruling on the objection when we come back at 1 sharp.
Court was adjourned, and I was led back to the courtside holding cell for the hour break. Maggie didn't join me there for almost a half hour, finally coming in with a sandwich Lorna had picked up at Cole's, as well as news from Arizona. "They got him," she said. "He was staying in his suite, having food brought in, and they thought they were going to have to door-knock him with the subpoena when he ventured out to the pool. They got him in a bathing suit and bathrobe."
"Tony Soprano," I said, recalling that the television mobster liked to lounge around the pool in a bathrobe.
"Exactly what I thought."
"They get it on video?"
"The whole thing. I have it on my phone. I can show you in the courtroom, but they wouldn't let me bring it in here."
I unwrapped my sandwich. It was roast beef on a roll. I took a bite and spoke with my mouth full.
"Good. So we have Aparicio for Wednesday,
if he shows up. I took another bite. The sandwich was delicious, but then I noticed she wasn't eating. You want some of this? I asked. It's great.
No, I'm too nervous to eat, Maggie said.
What, about the trial?
What else?
I don't know. I just didn't think Maggie McPherce ever got nervous.
You'd be surprised.
So, who is Aparicio using these days? Back during the Lisa Trammell case, he used Zimmer and Cross to try to quash our subpoena. They failed. I heard he fired them right after that.
As far as we can tell from documents we've located on Bio Green, he uses the firm of Dempsey and Giraldo for a lot of his stuff. Whether they provide criminal defense, I don't know.
Interesting.
Why?
I've run up against them before. They rep a lot of cops, especially Dempsey. Looks like with Aparicio, they're at the other end of the spectrum. Maggie pursed her lips, and I knew she was considering something.
What?
I said.
Just thinking, is all, she said.
I'd like to get a list of their clients who are cops, see if there's a connection to Officer Milton.
You can get that. They're not just going to give it to me.
No, but you have access to the county court's database. Put their names into it, and you'll get hits on every case they're involved with.
I took a leave, Mickey, remember? I could get fired if I did that.
You told me yesterday you were sneaking in to use your office phone.
That's different.
How's... Deputy Chan opened the cell door and told us it was time to go back to court. Maggie and I dropped the conversation there. Once we were back at the defense table, Maggie pulled her phone and played me the video she had received from Cisco in Scottsdale. She had the sound down low, but I could hear enough, and I could tell from Aparicio's contorted and red face that he was angry at being served with a subpoena. He was equally upset with the camera recording the event. He lunged at it, his bathrobe flapping open, and his flower-white gut hanging over his board shorts. The man behind the camera, one of Cisco's Indians, was lighter on his feet, and the lens swiftly moved out of range of Aparicio's swinging hand without ever losing him in the frame. The reference to Tony Soprano had been spot on, and I wondered if Aparicio himself embraced the resemblance. After missing the camera, Aparicio followed the momentum of his swinging arm and turned back towards Cisco. Aparicio took two steps toward him, while Cisco calmly stood his ground. I saw his shoulders and arms tense. So did Aparicio. He thought better of his move and stopped in his tracks. He went with the finger instead of the fight, pointing it at Cisco's face and yelling an empty threat at him. At no point did Aparicio say anything about the subpoena being invalid when served in another state. He clearly didn't know. Maggie cut the video as Chan announced that court was coming to order.
That's the end, she whispered. He runs back to his room after cussing Cisco out.
She dropped the phone into her briefcase as Judge Warfield took the bench. Before bringing the jury back in, the judge ruled on the objection I had made.
Miss Berg, you have accomplished what you set out to show, she said. Detective Drucker has testified to the experiments at the defendant's house, but his opinions about what the experiments mean are irrelevant. You will move on to another area of inquiry.
Another minor victory for the defense. The jury was brought in, and Detective Drucker returned to the stand. Berg completed eliciting his direct testimony an hour into the afternoon, ending with a line of questioning designed to outline the motive for my killing Sam Scales. Money. Through Drucker's testimony about the search of my records at my warehouse, she introduced the letter I had sent Scales in a final effort to collect the money he owed me. The letter was entered into the record as a state's exhibit without my objection. I didn't want to keep it from the jury. It was my belief that it cut both ways, and that would become clear when I put on my defense. Through her questioning, Berg tried to make it seem to the jury that the letter was a key piece of evidence that I had tried to conceal by burying it in records hidden in a massive warehouse full of other possessions and junk.
Where exactly did you find this letter in Mr. Holler's warehouse?
There was a small closet toward the back of his place. The door was kind of hidden behind a rack of clothes, but we found it. And inside, we found some file cabinets. The drawers were full of files and didn't really seem to be in any order. We found a file on Sam Scales, and the letter was inside it.
And when you read the letter, did you recognize it as potential evidence in the case?
Yes, right away. It was a demand, a final demand, for money that Holler believed he was owed.
Did you perceive the letter as a threat to Sam Scales?
Maggie hit my arm and nodded toward the witness stand. She wanted me to object before Drucker could answer, giving an opinion on what should be a jury decision. But I shook my head. I wanted Drucker's answer, so that I could turn it against him when it was my time.
Yes, definitely a threat, Drucker said. It says right in the letter that this was the final request before serious action would follow.
Thank you, Detective, Berg said. Now, the final thing I want to do is have you introduce a video in which you spoke to the defendant, but in his capacity as his own lawyer. Do you recall that conversation?
I do.
And it was video recorded?
Yes.
Let's play that for the jury.
Maggie leaned into me. What is this? She whispered. His last try to get me to confess, I whispered back. I told him to fuck off.
The video was played on the big wall screen over the clerk's station. It was from an interview room at Twin Towers. I had already been jailed for a week or so when Drucker and his partner, Lopez, came to see me to tell me what they had and to see if I would roll over.
We see you're going to defend yourself on this thing, Drucker said. So, we're here today to talk to you as a lawyer, not as the defendant, okay?
Whatever, I said. If you're going to talk to me as a lawyer, you should have a prosecutor with you. But you've had your head up your ass on this from the beginning, Drucker. Why do I get the dumbest pair of detectives on the squad who can't see what this is?
Sorry, we're so dumb. What is it we aren't seeing?
It's a setup. Somebody did this to me, and you bought it hook, line, and sinker. You're pathetic.
Well, that's why we're here. I know you said you won't talk to us, and that's your right, so we're telling you, the attorney of record on this, what we've got and what the evidence shows. Maybe it changes your client's mind, maybe it doesn't, but now is the time if you want to try to talk to us.
Go ahead. Tell me what you got.
Well, we've got the body of Sam Scales in the trunk of your car, and we can prove through ballistics and other evidence that he was killed in your garage when you were supposedly upstairs twiddling your thumbs.
That's bullshit. You're trying to bluff me. You think I'm that stupid?
We've got blood on the floor and ballistics. We found the slug on the floor of your garage, Holler. You did this, and we can prove it. And I gotta tell you, it looks like it was planned. That's first degree, and that's life without parole. Your client has a kid. If he ever wants to see that kid again outside of prison, now is the time for him to come in and tell us exactly what happened. Was it heat of the moment, a fight, what? You see what I mean, counselor? Your client is fucked. And there is a small window here where we can go see the DA to explain this and get you, him, the best deal possible.
There was a long beat of silence on the video as I just stared at Drucker. I realized that this was what Dana Berg wanted the jury to see. The hesitation looked like I was considering the offer from Drucker, and wouldn't only a guilty man pause to weigh the choice? That, of course, was not what I was doing. I was trying to think of a way to elicit more information about the case. Drucker had just mentioned two key pieces of evidence that at the time were new to me, blood and ballistics, a bullet slug found in my garage. I wanted to trick out more from him, and that was what the pause was all about. But the jury would not read it that way.
You want me to make a deal? I said on the video. Fuck your deal. What else you got?
Drucker clearly smiled on the video. He knew what I was doing. He'd given up all he was going to.
Okay, he said. Just remember this moment, when we gave you the chance.
Drucker started to get up from the table. Berg ended the video.
Your Honor, she said, at this time I have no more questions for Detective Drucker, but I request leave to bring him back for further testimony as the state's case progresses.
Very well, Judge Warfield said.
It is a little too early to take the afternoon break. Mr. Haller, Ms. McPherson, do you have questions for this witness?
I stood and moved to the lectern. Your Honor, I began, Detective Drucker will be a key witness during the defense phase of the trial, and I'll defer the bulk of my questions until then, but if I may, I will ask the witness a few questions now regarding the testimony he's given since the lunch break. There were things said that were incomplete and inexcusable, and I don't want them to languish in the minds of the jurors for even a day.
Berg stood up immediately.
Judge, I object to the characterization of the witness and his testimony, she said. Counsel is trying to—
Sustained, Warfield said.
You inquire, Mr. Haller. You do not argue. Keep your tone and opinions to yourself.
Thank you, Your Honor, I said, acting as though there had been no rebuke. I checked the notes I had scribbled on a yellow pad just a few minutes before.
Okay, Detective Drucker, I began. Let's talk about this letter you say you interpreted as a threat to violence.
I called it a threat, Drucker said. I didn't call it a threat to violence.
But isn't that what you are really saying, Detective? We're here because this is a murder case, correct?
Yes, this is a murder case. No, I did not say the letter was a threat to violence.
You didn't say it, but you want the jury to make that leap for you, correct?
Berg objected, saying I was already badgering the witness three questions into the cross-examination. The judge told me to watch my tone, but said that the witness could answer the question.
I am stating facts, Drucker answered. The jury can draw whatever conclusion or connection they see fit.
You said this mysterious closet where you found this letter was hidden behind a rack of clothes, correct? I asked.
Yes, there was a stand-up rack of clothes that obscured the door and that we had to move.
So now it's obscured and not hidden.
Is that a question?
This rack of clothes that hid or obscured the closet door, was it on wheels, Detective Drucker?
Yes, I believe so.
So when you said you and your fellow searchers had to move it, you mean you just rolled it out of the way, correct?
Yes.
And, by the way, was I present at this search?
You were.
But you didn't mention that earlier in your testimony, did you?
No, it didn't come up.
And was I not the one who told you to move the rack of clothes to get to the closet where I kept my financial records?
I don't recall that.
Really? You don't recall coming to my home with your search warrant and my volunteering to take you to my warehouse where I kept the records you wanted to search?
You did agree to meet us at the warehouse and open it for us so we wouldn't have to break the lock.
Okay, and once we were there, and you found this so-called hidden closet, did I not tell you what file drawer to look in for communications between me and Sam Scales?
I don't remember it that way, no.
Well, how many file cabinets were in the storage room, Detective?
I don't remember.
More than one?
Yes.
More than two?
I don't remember how many there were.
I disengaged from Drucker and looked up at the judge.
Objection, Your Honor, I said. The witness is unresponsive to the question asked.
Answer the question, Detective, the judge told the detective.
There were more than two, Drucker said. There may have been as many as five.
Thank you, Detective, I said. Did you search all five of those filing cabinets?
No. You said most of them contained client files and were covered by attorney-client privilege. You refused to unlock them.
But I unlocked the filing cabinet containing my financial records, isn't that right, Detective?
I don't remember whether it was locked.
But you remember that you were prohibited from searching some filing cabinets, but not the one you searched, is that correct?
I suppose that is correct.
So,
First, you didn't remember that I showed you the filing cabinet containing my financial documents, but now you admit that, in fact, I did show you where to search for my financial records. Do I have that right, Detective? Objection! Berg shouted. Warfield raised her hand to cut off anything further. This is cross-examination, Ms. Berg, she said. Impeachment of the witness's credibility is a proper issue of inquiry. Answer the question, Detective.
You did direct us to the filing cabinet, Drucker said. I apologize for my misstatement. I was not visualizing the events as I experienced them.
Okay, let's move on here, I said. You said you searched the cabinet, found the file on Sam Scales, and removed the document now marked as States L. Do I have that all right?
Yes.
Did you look for or take any other documents during the search of my records?
Yes. There were two earlier letters to Sam Scales of similar nature, asking for money.
You mean asking him to pay his legal bills?
Yes.
Did they include threats to violence if he did not pay?
Not that I recall.
Is that why they have not been introduced in court today? Berg objected and asked for a sidebar. I was on a roll with Drucker and didn't want to lose momentum. I withdrew the question, negating the objection and need for a sidebar, then pressed on. Did you take anything else from my storage files, Detective Drucker?
No, the warrant covered only financial communications between you and the victim.
So, you did not ask the judge who signed the warrant for permission to check my tax returns to see if I'd written off the Sam Scales debt as a business loss? Drucker had to think for a moment before answering. This was completely new information to be considered.
It's a simple question, Detective, I prompted. Did you? No, we did not ask for tax returns, Drucker said.
Do you think if you had known that this debt was turned into a tax deduction, it would have mitigated your belief that it was the motive behind the killing of Sam Scales?
I don't know.
Do you think it might have been good information to have as you investigated the case?
All information is good to have. We like to throw out a wide net.
But not wide enough in this case, correct? Berg objected to the question, saying it was argumentative. The judge sustained the objection, and that was what I wanted. I didn't want Drucker to answer the question. It was meant for the jury.
Your Honor, I said, I have no further questions at this time, but we'll be calling Detective Drucker back as a defense witness.
I returned to the defense table, while Berg called her next witness. Maggie gave me the nod for my first swing at Drucker.
Good stuff, she said. Should I have Lorna go to the warehouse and pull the tax return? We could use it as a defense exhibit.
No, I whispered. There is no deduction.
What do you mean?
You wouldn't know this because you've spent your life in public service. Same with Berg and same with Drucker. Even the judge was a public defender before she got elected. But a private attorney can't deduct unpaid fees as a business loss. The IRS won't allow it. You just have to eat the loss.
So it was a bluff?
Pretty much. About as much bullshit as them saying that letter I sent Sam was a threat to kill without really saying it. Maggie leaned back and stared straight ahead as she computed this. Welcome to criminal defense, I whispered. Chapter 44. Linear, methodical, routine. Dana Berg was following textbook case delivery. The prosecution usually had such advantages in terms of its wealth and reach that that was usually all it took. The state overwhelmed with its power and might. Prosecutors could afford to be unimaginative, even stodgy. They trotted out their cases to the jury like furniture instructions from IKEA, step by step, with big illustrations, all the tools you needed included. No need to look elsewhere. No need to worry. And at the end, you have a sturdy table that is both stylish and functional. Berg ran out the afternoon with testimony and video from the lead criminalist, who had been in charge of the crime scene, and then the deputy coroner, who had conducted the autopsy on the victim. Both witnesses were part of the building blocks of the state's case, even if they offered no evidence that directly implicated me. With the criminalist, I passed on the opportunity to ask questions. There was nothing to be gained there. With the coroner, Berg ran her direct examination past the usual 4:30 p.m. cutoff for testimony. Judge Warfield liked to use the last half hour of the day to dismiss the jury with warnings about avoiding media reports and discussing the case on social media or anywhere else, and then to check with the lawyers for any new business to consider. But I stood up to address the court before she could do it. "Your Honor, I have only a few questions for the witness," I said. "If I could get them in today, the prosecution can start tomorrow with a new witness, and Dr. Jackson will be able to go back to his important work at the coroner's office."
"If you're sure, Mr. Holler," the judge responded, a suspicious tone in her voice.
5 minutes, Judge, maybe less."
"Very well."
I went to the lectern with only my copy of the autopsy report and nodded to the witness, Dr. Philip Jackson. "Dr. Jackson, good afternoon," I began. "Can you tell the jury if it was your opinion that the victim in this case was obese?"
"He was overweight, yes," Jackson said. "I'm not sure he would be considered obese."
"How much did he weigh at autopsy?"
Jackson referred to his own copy of the autopsy report before responding. "He weighed 206 pounds, he said.
"And how tall was he?" I followed.
"He was 5'8".
"Are you aware that the National Institutes of Health Table of Desired Weights for Adults places the maximum optimum weight of an adult male 5'8" in height at 158 pounds?
"Not off the top of my head, no."
"Would you like to review the table, doctor?"
"No, that sounds about right. I don't dispute it."
"Okay, how tall are you, Dr. Jackson?"
6 foot even.
"And your weight?" As I expected, Berg stood and objected on the grounds of relevancy. "Where are we going with this, Judge?" she asked.
"Mr. Holler," the judge said, "we are going to adjourn and take this up in the—"
"Your Honor," I interrupted. "3 more questions and we'll be there, and the relevancy will be clear."
"Hurry, Mr. Holler," Warfield said. "You may answer the question, Dr. Jackson."
190, Jackson said. "Last I checked." There was a slight murmur of laughter from the jury box and gallery.
"Okay, so you're a relatively big guy," I said.
"When it came time during the autopsy to examine the victim's back for injuries, did you turn the body over yourself?"
"No, I had help," Jackson said.
"Why is that?"
"Because it's difficult to move a body that weighs more than yourself."
"I imagine so, Dr. Jackson. Who helped you?"
"As I recall, Detective Drucker witnessed the autopsy, and I enlisted his help in turning the body over."
"Judge, I have no further questions."
Berg had no redirect, and Warfield moved to adjourn court for the day. As she gave the jury the routine warnings, Maggie reached over and patted my hand.
"That was good," she whispered.
I nodded, and liked how she had touched me. It was my hope that the 5-minute cross-examination of Jackson would leave the jury with something to think about as they went home for the night. So far, Berg had offered nothing in the way of testimony or evidence that explained how I had gotten Sam Scales, who was essentially built like a mailbox, into the trunk of my car in order to shoot him. The possibilities ranged from my having an accomplice to help move an incapacitated Sam into the trunk, to my drugging him and then ordering him into the trunk at gunpoint before those drugs took effect. I didn't know whether Berg was planning to avoid the issue altogether or if something was coming further down the line in her presentation. But for the moment, at least, I had control of the issue. And it was a bonus that my weight loss since my initial arrest had now reached nearly 30 pounds, leaving me at least 50 pounds lighter than Sam Scales at death. I had checked the jury during my final questions to Jackson, and several were looking at me instead of the witness,
most likely sizing up whether I could have manhandled the 206-pound mailbox into the trunk of my car. Going to trial is always a gamble. The prosecution is always the house in this game. It holds the bank and deals the cards. You take any win you can get. As Deputy Chan came to collect me and take me back into courtside holding, I felt good about the day. I had spent less than 15 minutes cross-examining the state's witnesses, but felt I had scored points and put a hit on the house. Sometimes that was all you could ask for. You plant seeds that help keep jurors thinking and that hopefully sprout and bloom during the defense phase of the trial. For the third day in a row, I felt momentum building. I changed into my blues in the holding cell and waited for a runner to come get me and take me down to the dock. Sitting on the bench, I thought about where Dana Berg would take the trial next. It seemed to me that the case had largely been delivered to the jury through Drucker. Tomorrow would certainly center on my garage. The state's wit list included another criminalist who had handled the search there the morning after the killing, a DNA expert who would testify that the blood collected from the floor of the garage came from Sam Scales, and a ballistics expert who would testify about the analysis of the bullet evidence. But I couldn't help thinking that there was going to be something else, something not on the list. An October surprise, as members of the defense bar like to call a sandbagging by the prosecution. There was a clue to something coming. I had noticed that Kent Drucker left the courtroom after his testimony concluded. He was not replaced by his partner, Lopez, which meant that Berg was flying blind through the rest of the afternoon. No case detective on hand in case she needed documents or a refresher on aspects of the case. This rarely happened in a murder trial, and it told me something was up. Drucker and Lopez were working on something. It had to be case-related, because they would have been taken out of the homicide rotation once the trial started. I was sure there was an October surprise coming. This was how the rules of fairness and trial procedure were subverted. By putting off the investigative work on a witness or piece of evidence until trial is underway, the prosecutor can claim that it was a newfound witness or piece of evidence, and that is why there was no forewarning to opposing counsel. The defense did it as well. I'd had people poised to drop a subpoena on Louis Aparicio, who would be my own October surprise. But there was something inappropriate and unfair about it when the prosecution, which held all the power and all the cards, did it. It was like the New York Yankees always getting the best players because they had the most money. It was why my favorite team in baseball was whatever team was playing the Yankees. My thoughts were interrupted when the runner came to the holding cell to escort me down to the prisoner transport dock in the courthouse basement. 20 minutes later, I was in the back of a sheriff's cruiser being driven solo back to Twin Towers, courtesy of the order from Judge Warfield. I noticed that the driver was a different deputy from the one who had driven me that morning and last week. This driver seemed familiar to me, but I couldn't place him. Between the jail and the courthouse, I had seen so many different deputies in the past 4 months that there was no way I could remember them all. After we pulled out of the courthouse complex and onto Spring, I leaned forward to the metal grille that separated the driver from the rear compartment, where I was locked into a plastic form-fitting seat. "What happened to Bennett?" I asked. I had noted the name on the new guy's uniform when he was putting me into the car. Presley. It, too, was familiar, but not enough for me to place it. "Assignment change," Presley said. "I'll be driving you the rest of this week." "Sounds good," I said. "Have you worked in the keep-away module lately?"
"No, I'm in transport."
"Thought I recognized you."
"That's because I've sat behind you in court a few times."
"Really? This case?"
"No, this goes back. Alvin Presley is my nephew. You had him as a client for a while."
Alvin Presley. The name, followed by a face, came back to me. a 21-year-old kid from the projects, caught slinging dope with enough quantity in his pockets to qualify for a big-time prison sentence. I was able to score him a better deal, a year in the county stockade.
"Oh, yeah, Alvin," I said. "You stood for him at the sentencing, right? I remember his uncle was a deputy."
"I did."
Here was the hard question.
"So, how's Alvin doing these days?"
"He's doing good. That was a wake-up call for him. Got his shit together, moved out to Riverside to get away from all the crap. He lives with my brother out there. They got a restaurant."
"Good to hear.
Anyway, you did right by me with Alvin, so I'm going to do right by you. There's people in the jail not happy with you."
"Tell me about it. I know."
"I'm serious now. You got to watch your back in there, man."
"Believe me, I do know. You're driving me because I got choked out by a guy on the bus. You know about that?"
"Everybody knows about that."
"What about before? Did people know that was going to go down?"
"I don't know, man. Not me."
"The story they put in the paper today was bullshit."
"Yeah, well, shit happens like that when you're making waves. Remember that?"
"I've known that my entire life, Presley.
Is there something you want to tell me that I don't know?"
I waited. He said nothing, so I tried prompting him.
"Sounds like you took a risk asking to drive me," I said.
"Might as well tell it." We turned off Boucher Street and into the inmate reception garage at Twin Towers. Two deputies came to the car to get me and move me back up to the keep-away module.
"Just watch yourself," Presley said.
I had long assumed I was a target for any number of the 4,500 inmates held inside the jail's octagonal walls. Anything could spur violence. The cut of your hair, the color of your skin, the look in your eyes. Getting warned about the deputies charged with keeping me safe was another matter.
"Always," I said.
The door opened, and a deputy reached in to unlock my cuffs from the seat and then pull me out.
"Home sweet home, asshole," he said.
Chapter 45. Tuesday, February 25th. The morning session in court had not gone well for the defense. Through crime scene analysis, DNA, and ballistics, prosecution witnesses had convincingly offered proof that Sam Scales had been shot to death in the trunk of my Lincoln while it was parked in my garage. While the case was missing the murder weapon, and none of the evidence could put me in the garage pulling the trigger, it was what defense attorneys call common sense evidence. The victim was killed in the defendant's car, in the defendant's garage. Common sense dictates that the defendant was responsible. There was, of course, room in that chain of circumstances for reasonable doubt, but sometimes common sense was an overriding factor in a juror's decision. And whenever I had checked the faces of the jurors during the morning session, I never saw any skepticism. They were paying rapt attention to the parade of witnesses that wanted to bury me in guilt. Two of the witnesses I did not even bother to question on cross. There had been nothing in their testimony I could attack, no loose thread I could use to unravel their claims. With the ballistics expert, I thought I scored a point when I asked if any of the bullet slugs recovered in the case showed markings from a silencer being used on the weapon. His answer, as I knew it would be, was that sound suppression devices do not come into contact with the discharged bullet, so it is impossible to tell if such an attachment was on the murder weapon. But then, Dana Berg took the point away and scored her own when she used my question on redirect to bring out from her expert the fact that sound suppressors do not reduce the report of a gunshot to anything even approaching silence. I likened going into courtside holding during the lunch break to going into the locker room at halftime. My team was down, and I felt the weight of dread as Deputy Chan led me into the holding cell. After securing me, he would bring Maggie McPherson in with lunch, and I was sure we would discuss the morning session to see if there was any way to repair the damage when we moved into the defense phase of the trial. But those thoughts disappeared like smoke after I went through the steel door from the courtroom and was directed by Chan down the hallway to the attorney-client room. I immediately heard a voice echoing off the steel and concrete walls. A female voice. As we passed the holding cells on either side, I looked through the bars on the right and saw Dana Berg sitting on a bench in the cell. I remembered now that she had gotten up from the prosecution table the moment the judge had left the bench. Now, she was in the holding cell, but it wasn't her voice I'd heard. It was coming from another woman, but I could not see her because the cell extended to the right along a concrete wall beyond the barred door. I knew the voice. I just couldn't place it. Chan delivered me to the attorney-client room. "Hey, who's that Berg is with?" I asked casually. "Your old girlfriend," Chan said offhandedly. "What girlfriend?" "You'll find out soon enough." "Come on, Chan. If I'm going to find out, you might as well tell me." "I actually don't know. It's all on the down low. All I heard was that she was brought down from Chowchilla." He slid the solid steel door closed behind me, and I was left alone with the single clue as to who was in the cell with Berg. Chowchilla was up in California's Central Valley and the location of one of the biggest women's prisons in the state. While my client list ran 80% or more male, I had a few female clients in the prison system. I usually didn't track my clients once they were adjudicated and sent off to prison, but I knew of one former client who, last I heard, was serving a 15-year stretch for manslaughter in Chowchilla. It was her voice, distorted by echoes off steel and concrete, that I now recognized. Lisa Trammell. She was the October surprise. The door slid back open to allow Maggie to come in with the bag containing our lunch. But I had just lost my appetite. After the door banged closed again, I told her why. "They've got a witness they're bringing in, and we need to fight it," I began. "Who?" Maggie asked. "You hear the voices in the other cell? That's her, Lisa Trammell." "Lisa Trammell? Why do I know that name?" "She was a client. She was charged with murder, and I got her off." I saw the prosecutor in Maggie react. "Jesus, now I remember," she said. "They just brought her down from Chowchilla to testify," I said. "About what?" "I don't know. But I know the voice, and I know she's in there with Dana Berg. Her case was the one I hung on Aparicio in court. He was the straw man. I got him to take the fifth." "Okay, let's think about this." Maggie started opening the bag and taking out wrapped sandwiches Lorna had ordered from the Nickel Diner.